Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Tunesmate, episode 78. I'm Mark.
And I'm Ray.
And Ray, had an opportunity to catch up with John Bermuda Schwartz. You may remember he was on the podcast 3 years ago. So that's a lot to catch up on. And during that time, he released his second book. This time it was photos, all color, of Al behind the scenes. And he's also been on two tours. One of them ended up on a world tour across the pond. And he really talked about the fact that he still loves what he does, but touring, he would never tour 6 months again in a row. Four is okay, but six is a little too much.
Yeah, we know that touring is, it's part of the deal when you're a musician. There are some who don't go, but you know, for the most part, touring's part of what you do, and it's part of how you get your exposure out there. You grab new fan bases, you bring the music to the people, which is where music started to begin with. But you can kind of understand, especially as you get older, you know, we're a little bit younger than John, but you know, we both know, you know, you hit 40, you hit 50, you hit 60, you hit 70, and these things start to say, you know, I can't quite do what I used to. And so it kind of makes sense that you can kind of see like almost two ways about it, right? The one would be we do a shorter tour. The other one would be we have more time between dates, right? You know, so, and they probably both have their advantages, and I can definitely see the idea of, you know, well, let's tour for 4 months, and then we can take a little while off, and you know, but you got to, you're still getting out there, and it's part of, it's not just the sort of need to, it's the want to. Musicians like performing live. It's, you know, a lot of times what people got into this for, and so you still want to do this, but you got to recognize your own limitations.
Yeah, and it's interesting, as you'll hear in the interview, John got into a lot of details around how he and the band broached the subject of all of Al's complete catalog and how they mixed it up on the road. Cause I think that's another, you know, important aspect is that if you're going city to city, sometimes you're in the same city two nights in a row. And I even think Garth Brooks did this. Many artists are like, well, I'm going to be playing different set lists each night. And I think that's easier as you're an artist that has many, you know, a large catalog. But it's still not easy picking what songs you want to play.
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting point. We've never really talked about the sort of the strategy of the set list that, you know, there's decisions that go into what's going to come first, what's going to come in the middle, what's going to come last. I mean, you know, we've all probably been there. You're at a concert and you're driving there and you're like, what are they going to open with? And then you're in the middle of it and you're like, what are they going to close with? And you have discussions about that. And then the idea that, you know, I'm going to be in a city for a more than one night, let's change it up from night to night. But as you said, then you got to pick, what are you going to highlight? What are you not? And then when you've got a lot of hits or, you know, a lot of songs that people like, trying to pick the right ones and knowing somebody's probably going to walk away disappointed because I came to hear fill in the blank song and I didn't get to hear it. And I heard like all these other ones and, you know, you're just trying to, you can't go on for, and it's kind of the limitations again. You can't go on for 4 or 5 hours and cover them all. So you're making these decisions about that. And you know, that's a really interesting thing to think about. I think it'd be a fascinating thing to study, like the sort of art or the science of set listing.
Yeah, 100% agree. And I know many bands like Metallica, you know, Weird Al, they have these huge, they can go deep. They can just play all the hits. You reminded me of something that, when this was years ago when I went to see Van Halen, and most groups save their biggest hit for last, mm-hmm. you know, that encore.
Mm-hmm.
And I showed up and the first song they played was Jump. I was like, wait, what's happening? So I really think there is an art to it. I don't know what happened that night. They said, hey, let's just get the hit out of the way and then, you know, get into the new album or whatever they were doing at the time. I can't even remember. I think like setlist.com has all these set lists, yep, up there, but that was a head scratcher. I was like, wait a minute, what? You're just getting seated or whatever you're doing. You're like, wait a minute, their biggest hit, they're playing first?
Yeah, you know, and I guess in that one, you're exactly right. I don't know how many concerts I've been to, and yeah, they saved that big hit for the end or some other key moment in the concert. But with Jump, I can really, you know, it's a song that kicks things off well, right? You got the keyboard coming in at the beginning and then it's, you know, the whole idea of jump, let's jump into this. So I can kind of wrap my head around that one in a way that other artists, it wouldn't make as much sense.
Yeah, and the same thing with being a DJ is there's a very specific song you generally want to start out with, but it does depend on the audience. It does depend on the venue, where you're set up, the environment. If you had, a lot of these bands have some opening act. So did the opening act, did they smoke and you've got to match their intensity? So yeah, there's a lot of factors there that go into that first song, and maybe they need to switch it up to stay there. So I think we're onto an episode here.
No, I think it's something to talk about. I have plenty of examples running through my mind here already.
All right, well, stay tuned for another episode in the future. We hope you enjoy the interview with John. It was great to catch up with him, and we'll see you on the flip side of the interview.
And I have the honor of being joined today by Mr. John Bermuda Schwartz. John, how are you?
I am good. Hello, everybody. Hello, Mark.
Hey, it's great to catch up with you. I know it's been a while since you've been on the podcast.
Oh, I know, like 3 or 4 years or something like that. And lots happened in that time.
Yeah, that's amazing. One of the things that happened is you have been on a couple of tours. And could you talk about some of the music that you've been playing at those tours? And are there any impressionable moments that you walked away with?
Well, let's see. The tours that we've done in the last, in 2022 and in 23 was a continuation of the No Frills tour from 2018, or it was a revision of it, or a reprise, or whatever, or the unfortunate return is how it was billed. And that consisted of primarily a bunch of our originals, and we rotated several of them. It was a different show every night. Every set list was a completely different set list. I mean, some, you know, songs would get repeated, you know, 2, 3, 4 times a week, but the way they were paired up, it was a different show every single night. And on those nights where we had 2 nights in a row in the same city, we made sure that the 2 sets were completely different, that there weren't any repeats from night to night. So that, because people will come to both shows. So they came and Al would announce at the beginning of the show, you know, tonight is, you know, for those who were here last night, you know, this is going to be a completely different show. And the fans love that, you know, and they come to multiple shows, even when it's the same show, even when they know exactly what to expect. But on those tours, and again, primarily originals, and I think we rotated about 35 or 36 originals and played maybe 18, 19 of them a night. And the fans never knew what the set was going to be. I mean, we knew before the tour started what every night was going to be, but the fans would come to multiple shows because they would hear different songs. But they never quite knew what to expect. We learned it was sort of a game, and the first time we did that in 2018, there would be some fans that would, you know, post online what they saw at the show. And then, you know, somebody would go to a show the next night and it would be a pretty different show. And this would happen for like 2 to 3 weeks before the fans figured out exactly what songs were in the rotation. But again, they never knew what we were going to play night to night. So, and that encouraged attendance. I mean, they came to see different songs. We also threw in a straight cover song of in each encore. I mean, just played it, you know, fairly true to the original. You know, well-known, fairly well-known rock songs, Smoke on the Water by Deep Purple, Last Train to Clarksville by the Monkees, Honky Tonk Woman, The Stones. I mean, just did a whole bunch of stuff like that. Glad All Over by Dave Clark 5. We played Classical Gas. I mean, we did all sorts of wacky stuff. And of course, the fans had no idea what those were going to be. So once they learned that, you know, the 3, 4, 5 shows into the tour, that there were like 5 different cover songs, they began to get the idea. And in 2018, we learned 77 straight songs. And, you know, a lot of them we had played in bands before, but, you know, we basically had to work up 77 songs so we could play each one time at each of the 77 shows. And when we came back and sort of redid that tour, the No Frills tour in 2022, we cut back the number of different songs that we did. So some of them got repeated a few times. I think we had like 35 to choose from or something like that. So we, you know, it was, if we came back to a certain metro area where we had played a song, we made sure we didn't play that song again there because we knew some of the same fans would be there. But again, this was, and this was a 27-week tour with no breaks in 2022. And so there were a lot of shows. And fans would come to multiple shows, and we went in and out of metro areas several times in some cases. So, you know, we're very aware that the fans would like a different show, you know, if they can, you know, if they've come to see a show, they don't want the exact same show. Now, there are in 2019, we did a tour where it was the same show every night. Actually, we had one song that we switched out from night to night, but it was essentially the same show. And that's pretty much how the tours have been in the past. And I think that's pretty much how the next tour coming up will be, is it will be the show again. And, you know, we'll bring back the videos and the costumes and all of that stuff. But 2022, 27 weeks, and no breaks. Now, this is still on the tail end of COVID protocols, for us. And we went out, we tested every night. We wore masks almost everywhere. We didn't go into restaurants and really just watched what was going on. Yet, basically all of us, at least all of us on the band bus, managed to catch COVID at various times throughout the tour. Nobody got terribly sick. And actually, Al was the first to catch COVID. And of course, you know, we don't have subs for him. You know, we each had people lined up in case something happened with us, but you can't do that with Al. So we missed four shows that we made up in 2023 at the beginning of that tour. But made it through that tour really well. I mean, and, you know, again, everybody who caught COVID did not get really sick. It was just, you know, you don't want to expose the rest of the band because someone will catch it and they may get really sick. You know, and again, you don't want that to happen to anyone. You certainly don't want it to happen to Al, you know, again. So 2022 was a very cautious tour. It was a very long tour. Came back. We played some great venues. We played Kennedy Center. We played Carnegie Hall. Actually, we wrapped up at Carnegie Hall at the end of October of that year. And that was a very cool gig. I mean, that's really, you know, anywhere that the Beatles have played for me is a very cool place. So Red Rocks and Hollywood Bowl and London Palladium we played in 2023. Just very cool tour. And the 2023 February and March tour was kind of a world tour. We made up for the four missed dates in the upper Midwest that Al had missed in 2022. We added a date as well, in fact. And then we went off to Europe. We started in Dublin and we played Glasgow and we played London and Hamburg. We were in Germany for the first time, Hamburg, Berlin, Dusseldorf we played. We played Paris for the first time. We played Brussels, some dates in the Netherlands, a couple of new cities, new venues, but some of the same countries. We played Vienna, Austria for the first time. Anyway, we were there almost about 4 weeks and it was a great time and the people were great. Language was not a barrier, and I'm not saying we speak any of the languages there. They all speak English well enough to communicate, certainly. We had, and the audiences were great. It was a fun time. Then, after about 4 weeks, we're off to Australia for two and a half weeks, and did several shows down there, several two-night-in-a-row shows. And that was the first time, actually, it was the first time we took our No Frills tour overseas. So, you know, they really had to be familiar with the originals. You know, this was not a show where, you know, a mainstream audience would be familiar with parodies because we weren't doing any. We basically sprung that on them and it went over very well. And again, our fans, you know, they kind of know what to expect. They don't know what the set is, but they knew this tour was going to be an all originals tour. So two very successful legs of that tour, and 2024 is a year off for us.
Well, that's amazing. And all that touring. So you were in many places that you probably haven't been in quite a while. Was there anything that touring taught you? Was there something that you walked away with?
I think perhaps that 6 months without a break is too long to be on the road. I mean, you know, there are young bands that don't tour that hard. And there's a couple of reasons we did that. I mean, you know, one is it's simpler to maintain a crew and to maintain the logistics of the tour, like buses and things like that, if you don't start inserting breaks in there where they start going looking for other work. You know, they can't just take 2 weeks off, you know, the way we can, you know. So that was really the main consideration in doing that all in a row. I really don't think we would do that again because it was really starting to wear on us. We've done 4 months before. That's not really a problem, but the fifth month was a tough one. And it just beats you up. It's a lot of being dragged around. It's not even the playing 5 nights a week. That's nothing. All the transportation, all the movement, just, you know, packing and unpacking basically every day for that length of time is hard. Now, the one cool thing that happened is, you know, in our hard month, in the fifth month, and the crew, I got to say, the crew was having probably a harder time than we were because they work together a lot more during the day than we do. I mean, we sort of show up in time for sound check, and that's when we see each other. they've been working, you know, since 9 a.m. So they're in each other's face. And there's a couple of things, a couple of guys were getting a little testy. But in the 5th month, everyone began to realize, oh, we only have a month to go and then we'll be done. We'll be home. So all the attitudes, as quickly as they had sort of heated up, kind of cooled down. And I think in the end, everybody was very appreciative for the work. It was a hard tour. And that's not to say we wouldn't do 6 months again. We're just not going to do 6 months in a row the way we did. And I think that's going to make life a bit easier for everyone. And they'll just have to work out the logistics of, you know, keeping all our stuff in a truck and having to pay for that for a couple of weeks while we take a little time off. That's the cost of doing business and staying healthy and staying sane.
Well, I'm glad you made it out the other side. And talking about the tour, so these were a collection of the pastiches that Al has done?
Yes. So this was...
What'd you say?
With one exception. We did a little medley at the... end of the encore, we would do the cover song, and then we would do a medley of parodies, but they would be in a different style, like a Surgeon would be sort of a Latin style, and you know, Eat It was a ballad. We had done that before, but we basically strung together, you know, Smells Like Nirvana was in there, and we strung together 4 or 5 parodies and did them in a little medley, and that was just to sort of represent, you know, what Al was best known for, and you know, so that people that weren't sure what to expect at a Weird Al show at least got to hear something they might be familiar with. But really, the tour was aimed at the hardcore fans, you know, who really, a lot of them like the originals better than the parodies. And in some cases, the originals are better than the parodies. So we had a great time. I don't think anybody came away disappointed unless they didn't get to hear their favorite song that night. You know, somebody else got to hear it the night before and they didn't get to hear it that night. But that's how we kept that fresh. And that's partly how we were able to stay touring without any fresh product, without a new album, is to change up the show. And in 2019, we went out and had an orchestra at every show that played the entire show with us. You know, it was called the Strings Attached Tour, as opposed to No Strings Attached. And that was a successful tour. Again, we played everything we played, the fans had heard, but they hadn't heard it with an orchestra before. And when we went out on the No Frills Tour, there were no videos, no costumes, there's no kind of backing tracks with any, you know, fancy percussion on it that we love so much. It was just us, and for better or worse, but the fans loved it, you know, and most of the originals aren't as demanding as the parodies anyway. I don't think we could do an unplugged parodies tour very easily. It worked out well. The pastiches, or the style parodies, as we also call them, went over very well. And that format may return in the future, but I think the next tour is going to be more of the regular show that the fans had come to expect, that the mainstream audiences have come to expect.
And out of all those original songs that you've created, is there a unique drum sequence that you have felt is one of the strongest that you've worked on?
Well, almost none of the originals were programmed. And if they were, it was very, very simple. Like Dare to Be Stupid was programmed, but that was very, very simple. You know, Wanna Be Your Lover was programmed with a lot of samples and loops and stuff, most of which I was in charge of. And I guess that was, of the originals, that was probably the hard one. That probably took the most time and turned out great, I thought, you know. And we, you know, when we played that live, now that, I don't, you know what? We did not do that on the Unplugged tour. But when we've played it in the regular show, there are, you know, of course, I'm playing drums on it, live drums that didn't exist on the original. But we also are running a track of the loops that help make that song sound like it sounds. Otherwise, it sounds like a bar band doing it. We, you know, there's some things we just can't pull off and make it sound any good, you know. And that was one of those originals that was not included on the playlist on these tours.
And how about the song Albuquerque? That seems to be a fan favorite over the years. Is that the longest song that you play or you've recorded?
I think both. It was a long song to record. And when we do it in concert, we restart it towards the end. We restart it from the beginning and play for like a couple more minutes and then resume the end. So it takes a long song and adds 2, 3, 4 minutes to it sometimes. I think one time we restarted it and played the entire song, which was not normally the plan. Al would usually sort of give us a cue, you know, to pick it up back at the end. You know, he remembers what the end is now. And we were kind of waiting for that. And we were going and going and going. And we ended up playing the song basically twice. We did like almost a 20-minute Albuquerque song. And at the tempo that is, it's pretty fast. It's one of the faster songs in the catalog. That's hard. That's a hard song. So yeah, longest on every count. Yeah, definitely longest on every count.
That's amazing. Yeah, I can't imagine how you feel after running that twice through. And another question for you, wondering about, there's a lot of non-recorded songs that are out there. For example, the famous one was Chicken Pot Pie that I've heard played at concerts. Was it the Who song? Was it Pitted Prunes or something? I'm trying to remember the name of that. And then I believe the other one we talked about was Laundry Day. Is there a favorite non-recorded album song that you get a chance to play?
I sort of like all of them. I mean, because it's something the fans are hearing that's really, truly special to the concert, you know, to a live show. I like them all. I mean, Laundry Day is fun. We did sort of a made-up theme from the Home Improvement show, but it was the Friends theme, I'll Be There For You by the Rembrandts. And we would do that, and it was I'll Repair For You. And, you know, the premise was that Al submitted that to the network, you know, as a theme for that show, for the Home Improvement show, but they turned it down. So, you know, and we'll play it for you now. And so it was that. I forget what tour or tours we did that on, but, and it's funny, it wasn't for lack of a new album's worth of songs. I mean, it's not like we didn't have new songs to play. You know, that's something actually we could do now, is start just cooking up songs, concert-only songs that nobody's ever heard, you know, that you really got to come to a show to hear, because we don't have a new album. So, you know, this is the time to just start making stuff up to play in concert. And, you know, who knows? Yeah. That could happen. It's hard to say. But, yeah, I would say that the theme from Home, I'll Repair For You, I think that was a fun song. They're all fun. Any song that I'm playing up there is fun.
The one that always got me was the Snack All Night, because I felt as though it was the complete trilogy of Michael Jackson. You know,
yeah.
Move it all through. But
I don't remember if we ever did an entire version of that, or if that always was just kind of in the medley, which is where a lot of songs ended up that were either not recorded or had been played to death, you know, in concert, and it was time to make room for other songs, but we still had to represent Eat It, for example, which is how, you know, Eat It ended up in the medley, you know, and not a complete song, you know, at some point in the touring years. Where was I going?
I think you're talking about the fact that you have an opportunity now to bring back some of these classics or mix them in because of the new tour that you're planning in the future.
Well, yeah, I mean, certainly we're going to return to parodies and some originals, and there's probably, I mean, Al's done, well, we did a new song for the Al Yankovic Story movie. And I think we should play that. You know, that would be cool. You know, and again, new, something new in concert. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of opportunities to bring something fresh to this next tour. And I'm sure Al will do that. You know, he doesn't want to just go play the same old songs the same old way, because then people stop coming to see that after a while. And, you know, if we can't cook up any new songs, let's play the old songs in a different way. Let's add an orchestra. Let's strip it down and just play it like we're a bar band, you know, kind of unplugged style, you know, just something, a new treatment for these. So, you know, we'll see what the next tour brings. I think it's going to be a good one.
And you mentioned it. I was going to ask you about this. So for the movie, I saw you were portrayed, and I wondered how you felt about that, or how was it received by the fans?
I thought it was a really good movie. I thought it was very well acted. I mean, obviously, almost none of it is true. It was interesting because Al sent me the auditions, all of the actors who auditioned for all of our parts, for the whole band, and for the two different age ranges, him as a kid and then him as a teenager. I've got copies of all of those auditions, and there's some really good talent in there. And I wasn't really, you know, it wasn't so that I could, you know, give my input. I wasn't really involved beyond just doing some recordings for the movie. But Al did ask me after he knew I had a chance to watch him. He said, you know, we're looking at these three guys to play you. You know, what do you think? And I think the one I picked happened to be also the one he was leaning towards, a guy named Tommy O'Brien, and who's a drummer, plays drums, but he's mostly an actor. I think he did a really good job. I think he played the part very seriously, which is kind of how I am, very matter of fact with Al. I mean, I'm not the wacky one in the band. And he played that well. And I got a chance, I got in touch with him. Al sent me his email and we stayed in touch for a while. And I finally met him not long ago and sat down and chatted with him. And he came to see one of my gigs and a very nice guy, a great guy. He told me that, that in sort of researching my part or his part of, you know, playing me, that, you know, he knew I always took pictures of everything. I mean, I was well known for taking photos. And he said he had thought about like just having a camera with him at all times. I said, you should have done that. I said, Al would have absolutely loved that. It would have been completely, you know, not to be using it, taking pictures, of course, but just to always have it there, always have it, you know, on you would have been exactly, that was me. You know, I always had a camera. And, you know, so in the sequel, we'll see. I doubt there'll be a sequel, but, and he's going to be too old to play me anyway. I'll get to play me if there's a sequel.
What was it? I saw it posted, I believe Al put on Twitter or something, you know, every 37 years, I like to put out a movie.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So when he's, you know, 101, another movie. Can't wait.
Well, I'll be waiting. I enjoyed UHF immensely as well. A couple other things here I think are fascinating. So you mentioned photos. And since we last spoke, you also put out your second book. And this time it's in color. And I was at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame recently and I saw it on display. And I saw it was being sold. Actually, I saw someone purchase it when I was walking out. I thought that was interesting. How's the second book and how was that received? I know we haven't had a chance to talk about that.
It was received very well. But as the publisher explained, and it has come to pass so far, sequels and follow-ups don't always do as well as the first one. And it's at this point in time, it's sold about half as well as the first one, which sold very, very well, I should add. So it's doing fine. Fans love it. It spans a much longer period of time because with Al, I only shot black and white deliberately in a very short period and some very specific things like videos and some studio stuff. I also shot color in those cases too, but I only used black and white during about a 3-year period with him. And what made those special is that nobody had seen those. You know, they weren't printed. Only a couple of them were printed. Most of them just existed on contact sheets. You know, I was the only one that really had ever seen them. But the second book, Lights, Camera, Accordion, had spanned a longer period of time. It was, you know, taken from all of my color film photos. So there was, again, a little bit of a limited period. It was only 25 years, you know, that I shot film with Al. From 1981 through 2006 was the last film I shot on Al. And I'd already been shooting digital at that point for 7, 8, 9 years. So, but digital was still not, the quality just wasn't there. I knew that if something was important, like when we did the album cover for Straight Outta Linwood, I knew that I wanted to capture that on film. I knew that my digital camera would not stand the test of time, that those images, the resolution just wouldn't hold up, you know, in the future, because I could see how fast digital was advancing. So really 2006 and maybe 2007 or so was the last time I shot film at all. So there's about 50% more photos in this book. There's a little bit more text and descriptions about the photos because they cover more different topics than the 6 chapters and basically 6 events of the first book, videos and studio work. You know, you have a whole chapter devoted to Ricky, a whole chapter devoted to I Love Rocky Road, et cetera, et cetera. This book, I think we went pretty much by album during the 25 years and which included, you know, whatever was going on in the studio and then the subsequent tour. So each chapter was kind of based on the album dates. And a bunch of the photos, to be honest, had been posted online before. But they were posted at a time early on when resolution wasn't, you know, bandwidth was very narrow. Resolution wasn't very good. Screens were still, maybe if you had an 800 by 600 monitor, that was big, you know, in the mid 90s, that was a big deal. And so the scans I did of, you know, and again, taken from prints, not prints, but prints, were not, you know, they looked okay on a screen like that, but they were small. And they were because people were on dial-up for the most part. I didn't make the files very big. I mean, a photo file might be 20 or 25K, which is impossibly small. So people had seen mm-hmm. these photos before, but they never had seen them the way they looked in print, taken from the negatives for the first time and cleaned up and properly, you know, I don't want to say retouched, but, you know, I work on the density and work on the color and in a way that you just can't do from a 4x6 snapshot and scan it and then crunch it up so it'll go over a phone line and show up, you know, as a, you know, 320 by 240 photo, which on some screens was pretty big. Now it's mm-hmm. impossibly small. So again, the photos that have been seen before, they look great in the book. And there are a lot of photos that are new to the book. And so, and for that reason, the fans love it. Al actually likes the second book better than the first one. And I mean, I like them both. It's hard for me to judge because that's my work and some of the stuff I've been seeing for years and years. And then I sat down and pored over it as I scanned them. And I pored over them again as I went through to pick out what photos I wanted to use. And then looked at them again and then had to write text for, you know, some of the photos. And so a lot of work went into that. I spent more than 4 months every day scanning all of my negatives, all of my color negatives. And it was, you know, I relived, you know, and it goes back before Al. I mean, I was, you know, shooting stuff back in the 70s. And it was just reliving my whole teenage years through, you know, mid-adulthood, one frame at a time. And it was very interesting. It was very, very cool. I mean, I saw old cars and old pets and old drums, you know, old family pictures, old tour pictures, old pictures of other bands, pictures I, you know, inventory pictures that I would take of my stereo gear and my drums and stuff like that. And just, it was very, very cool to see that stuff, you know, come across the screen, you know, clearer than I'd ever seen them before. So as far as the second book, it's widely available. First book actually sold out. It is sold out. I don't know if we're going to do a second printing. Some of the bookstores, I think Barnes & Noble bought a bunch to begin with, and they still have some. Amazon goes in and out of having some, but the distributor's out of them, so I don't know where they're getting theirs. But the first book basically is sort of done, and the second book is in progress, and again, very happy with it, and it's you know, at Christmas time, of course, it sells very well, did very well this past December. And it's, you know, I'm very happy with it. And I think the publisher's happy with it as well.
There's a lot of other holidays coming up in 2024 to surprise someone with. And it sounds like photos definitely part of it. I know you said you moved into digital. Does that mean that not only photos, you have video or what are, you know, how is your, I guess, archival process evolved with modern technology?
Well, I have some video. I've shot some in the studio and you know, sometimes just on the bus rolling down the road, you know, I'll wander through with my camera, or actually these days I just use my iPhone. And I'll be going down and they know when I'm looking at the screen and holding up, you know, the device, they know they're on camera, and sometimes they hide and sometimes they act up and, you know, I don't know that that stuff would ever see the light of day, but everything is archived and put away. Where I can, I like to get videos of the concerts. It's not always possible. Sometimes the lighting's not quite right. Mm-hmm. And that's, in fact, that's another thing is I finally have gone through recently and digitized all of my old videotapes, all of my old VHS tapes, and a lot of concerts from the 80s and into the 90s on VHS and high 8 format as well. And that was very interesting. And you know, fortunately or unfortunately, when you're doing audio or video or things like that from a tape, from an analog source, it has to be transferred in real time. I can't just push a button and it just copies over somehow. It has to run. It has to play. And, you know, it's tempting to sit down and in front of the screen and just watch it as it goes by. And I did that quite a bit. And there were some shows I knew there were funny things that happened, so I'm sitting down and watching those. And it was, again, a chance to kind of relive that. Quality on those was not great. Screen resolution was only 480 lines high, which essentially is pixels. So you're talking about a very small image. Now, they could technically be upsampled and make something a little more enjoyable on a proper screen. I don't know that there'd ever be a need for that, but I've got all of that stuff finally digitized and backed up a few different ways so that nothing bad will happen to it. And but it was very cool to do that. And, you know, and not just Al stuff, but I mean, other bands too, that I would take my giant VHS, you know, they called it portable back then, but it was quite a big device, you know, and I would set that up on a tripod and I would shoot, you know, whatever local other band I was playing in. I've got a bunch of those videos too. And they're interesting to watch, maybe only for me. And some of the Al stuff would be interesting for fans, but that's something, you know, Al will have to decide down the line if he ever wants to release a static shot of the stage of an old show, you know, with kind of fuzzy lighting and, you know, marginal sound. You know, it's strictly for archival purposes. It's not really, I don't see a commercial potential for any of the videos I've done. Even the stuff I've done on more modern cameras, I don't know that any of it has turned into something that would have any mass appeal, you know, that would have any mainstream potential.
It's great you had the opportunity to go back and relive that. So for you, thinking about what's coming up for you, it sounds you've got a couple things coming out. Just wonder what's next for John.
Well, again, this year is off, and which is expected. We do typically two years of touring, and then we take a year off, and we come back and do another couple of years, and then take another year off. So there is a plan for a tour in 2025. But for this year, I'm just enjoying the time at home, which actually I had a lot of that time at home in 2023 as well. After I got home at the end of March, I was off the rest of the year. It's allowed me to get back and work more with the local bands I work with, and which I play in between four and five bands in town when I'm off the road. So I've got several gigs coming up already. And more, you know, to follow, I'm sure, I hope. Might get a chance with the pandemic and all that, and then me being on the road finally. Haven't had much time to go and take any personal time away with my wife, you know, to take a vacation somewhere, you know, or at least a weekend away, something. There hasn't been a lot of opportunities for that. So now that things are a lot safer out there, and that, you know, flying on a plane or, you know, going to a hotel is not a scary thing anymore so much, I think we'll take some opportunities and do a little traveling. I'm beginning to thin out the herd, meaning H-E-A-R-D, my instruments, my drums and cymbals and stuff. I'm starting to get a plan together to let go of a lot of that stuff. I'm still, when it's all said and done, I'm still going to have a ton of stuff. But I have a lot of stuff right now. And that's not something I'm using most of it. I'm not using anymore. And two, not something I really want to stick my wife with having to deal with, you know, when I'm gone, if it's just around and I go first, you know, I just, that stuff should see a better home. And, you know, we could see a few bucks too. If I can handle it first without leaving that up to her it would be a pretty big burden. So that's kind of, I'm beginning to put that together, photos and stuff. And I already do have the website, thinningtheherd.com, H-E-A-R-D, a little pun there. And, I'm beginning to list some things on there and beginning to make that public. So that's something that I do, you know. Every week I kind of look into moving forward on that a little bit. And I don't know. I think, you know, sitting around and relaxing is not a bad thing either. I don't always have to be on the go.
No, that's great to hear. And my final question for you, I was thinking about this. It's, you've done so much work over the years, and we talked about all the music you've done. If someone was just learning about your work, also all the work you've done with Weird Al Yankovic, is there some place you think they should start? I mean, obviously they can stream everything, but is there like a quintessential album you would recommend someone to say, hey, if you want to get into John or Weird Al Yankovic, I would tell them to start here?
Well, I always think that the most recent album is the best album, production wise mm-hmm. and quality of writing, and you know, and it's more current, although our last album came out almost 10 years ago. That's the most current parodies of the more current songs in somebody's memory. So at any given time, I always think it's the most recent album. So I would say Mandatory Fun would be the album to check out. I mean, I'm very proud of my work on that. Love the songs on there. I think it's some of Al's best work. And it's current, you know, it's even at 10 years old, it's more current than saying, well, you should check out the album with Eat It from, well, that's 40 years ago now. That came out, I think, 40 years ago this month. That's wow. That's a long time. And nothing wrong with that album. But again, each album gets better and better, and leading all the way up to Mandatory Fun. So I would say if you're going to get one Al album, I mean, even more than a best of or something like that, if you're going to get one single studio album, Mandatory Fun is the one.
You heard it from John. So if you're looking to understand John's work or Weird Al Yankovic, start with the latest, the last one that was released. And I enjoy that one from front to back as well. Oh, well, John, I appreciate you taking the time out, and best of luck to everything that you're working on. It sounds like you're in need of a much needed break with all the touring that you've done, all the work that you've done. I would highly recommend checking out the second book and also everything that you're doing. And you did mention the new website that's going to be out there. Any other parting words before we commence?
Nope. I'm very grateful and thankful for, you know, the fans out there who provide careers for Al and in turn me and the guys in the band. It's been a really good ride, and I don't see the end in sight. I don't know. It hasn't slowed down. It's fun. It's still fun. And I enjoy it. I really, and I still enjoy the travel. I don't enjoy 6 months without a break, but I basically enjoy being out there and playing for the fans, and, you know, very, very thankful for all of that. And we're, you know, not everybody gets to do that. People work a lot harder at it to try and make it in the business and make a living doing what they like doing, and they don't get to do that. And we all got to do that. And I think we're all very grateful for that. So thanks to the fans.
Well, keep doing what you're doing. And I'm definitely send you well wishes on everything and best of luck. And thanks again for being on the podcast.
Oh, thank you very much, Mark. Appreciate it.
Bye, John.
All right, Ray. Well, welcome back. That was fascinating. Interesting to hear John talk about all the stories on the road, everything he approached. But the one thing that jumped out to me was he started talking about, well, maybe some new music. For example, Al released on the soundtrack to the movie that was out a couple years ago now, there was a brand new song that Al created. It's called Now You Know, which was in the title credits. And it seems as though that's the future of some artists, where they're just going to release a single every now and then, maybe an EP. And maybe that's a reflection of how music is being streamed and marketed now.
Yeah, I think it definitely is. We've talked about this before. It's kind of, it's going full circle. If you go back to the 50s, you released 45s, and you would release a song at a time. And then, you know, probably early 60s or so, the idea of an album really kind of started to take hold. And then, you know, we went through decades worth of, that was the standard. You put out an album, you had so many hits on it, you know, some artists would put filler in there. And now we're kind of going full circle, the beginnings of rock and roll period of pop music. It's evident of the changing times and the changing media, that so much of it is about streaming, people wanting to hear a song. It's about audience satisfaction. So you've got a new song out. It's the idea, I'm going to put it out now. The audience is waiting to hear from something for me. I'm keeping myself in the spotlight. I'm not, you know, going away the way famously Michael Jackson or Def Leppard would, you know, go away for 4 years and then suddenly here they are again. And, you know, and that's a narrative that's still out there, but it's in the sort of hyper intensity media environment we live in. the sort of instant gratification of online access to entertainment, it kind of makes sense to move more toward a singles-based strategy for releasing music, and especially for Al, right? You know, that you've got, he does these parodies, and a lot of them are time sensitive, and so, you know, you want to catch that song and the parody of the song right when the song is still popular, rather than, okay, I'm gonna, you know, figure out 5, 6, 7 of these and then put out an album. And maybe, I mean, and he's been successful with doing that in the past, but now you can kind of catch that even more quickly doing that.
Yeah. And in the same vein, I asked John, I said, well, you know, if somebody wanted to find out, maybe they never heard a Weird Al before, where would you start? And sure, you can always say the greatest hits album. I think that's always something I've heard some artists say, but he went back to Mandatory Fun, which was Al's last album, because he said that's the most recent, that has the best production, the best quality. So if you think about that, that is fascinating to me, is when you ask an artist, what should they check out? Many a times, it's the most recent one, and sometimes it could be the one they're promoting right now, but that album was out, I believe, 10 years ago.
Yeah, it was. It was 2014, so it's been 10 years since that came out.
Yeah, it's fascinating. So, but I think in this case, because of parodies and songs, as you said, that are relevant, I think that's why John exactly picked that one, because most people still should be familiar with the songs from that, even though it was 10 years ago. There's a lot of songs on there that capture Al in a way that...
Well, and I mean, yeah, you look at it, you know, Foil, or you look at Word... I mean, I thought Word Crimes was actually his best song ever. I remember when that came out, and I'm like, oh my God, this is amazing, you know? Or
yes.
Tacky for Happy. These are all... Inactive for Radioactive. These are all songs that folks still know. And so that are, like you said, they're 10 years old, but they're still, I mean, you'll still hear Royals on the pop radio. You'll still hear Radioactive on pop radio, right? So they're still prominent enough that, yeah, that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense.
Well, John said that next he's going to take some time off, but they'll be back out there in the road in 2025. So Weird Al and John and everything that band is doing is not over. So look forward to more coming from Weird Al, whether that's going to be a single or something else. And Ray, that's the same exact thing with Tunes Made, is we're constantly churning out those lost songs, those hits you forgot about from an artist. And that's why I always come back to Tunes Made. I check it daily. I hope everyone else does. Subscribe to our podcast. Follow our blog. Ray, keep cranking out those 80s, those daily 80s flashbacks. I'm enjoying them. You put one out there the other day that I was like, oh my gosh, this is amazing.
Yeah. No, it's still fun to do. We're almost at 10 years of daily 80s flashbacks. In June, it's going to be 10 years that I've been doing every single day. We haven't repeated a single song. I haven't run out of top 10 hits. Just had Born to Be My Baby by Bon Jovi just out. And then I'm also, but we're also going to deep tracks. I was rediscovering Thompson Twins' most successful record, Into the Gap. I put the last song that wasn't released as a single, and I'm listening to it. And I don't know if I've ever heard it before. If I have, it's been years. And I'm like, this is actually really good. And then there was... and I don't know if this one you're talking, Roman Holiday, One Foot Back in Your Door. I'm listening to it, and I hear this line, One Stop Miracle, I'm Your Man. And I'm like, wait a minute.
Billy Ocean.
Wait a minute. Yes. So, and it's a Mutt Lange. He either wrote or produced it. I looked it up, and I'm like, this has got to be Mutt Lange. And sure enough, it is. And this is 3 years before Billy Ocean, three and a half years before Billy Ocean, same line. He recycled his own line for Get Out of My Dreams, Get Out of My Car, that went to number one years later. And I was like, oh my gosh. And you know, it's amazing the stuff you can find by doing this.
And I heard it, and I didn't do any research on it, and I'm listening, and I caught that line, and I also felt like it could have been a Def Leppard song.
Yep.
And I was like, wait a minute, is that from a Def Leppard song or a Billy Ocean song? And then I started tracing it back, and I was wondering, maybe that was in the Adrenalize album, and I couldn't place it. Yep. And then it finally hit me, but you could have gave it to Shania Twain as well.
Well, and that's interesting, because when I first heard the line, my instant reaction was Def Leppard too. And then I remembered, no, wait, that line's from Billy Ocean. I had to like play the line in my head, right? Like hear it sung out. And then I remembered what song it was, but yeah, no, the Def Leppard connection, you know, we know, yeah, Shania Twain, Bryan Adams, you know, all the folks he worked with, but it's some of the best stuff about Tunes Mate and about doing Tunes Mate. And this is why I encourage people to check out what we're doing here. We're about the love of music, and it just is that discovery, those moments of, oh my gosh, I never knew that. Or look what I just heard that I never realized, or that I realized years ago and I'd forgotten about. And that's the joy. That's the fun of following music.
Exactly. So kick off your day and kick off your week. And once again, we appreciate you following us here, subscribing to our podcast. And once again, I'm Mark.
And I'm Ray.
And we will see you next time.